From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, in for Michael Krasny. In the hour ahead, we consider the rapidly growing and changing field of cybersecurity and the ethics involved in working in that business. San Francisco plays host this week to two gatherings, chock full of cybersecurity techies and hackers. RSA Corporation has held its event for years, but revelations that the cybersecurity giant may have colluded with the U.S. government to provide increased surveillance opportunities has many in the business crying foul. As a result, an alternative to RSA's conference sprang up and will be going on this week as well. It's called TrustyCon. We'll talk this hour about how cybersecurity and hacking have changed over the years. That's coming up next on Forum. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. The annual RSA Corporation's trade show and meeting is taking place this week in San Francisco. This year, however, RSA is facing criticism following allegations that the cybersecurity giant joined forces with the U.S. government's NSA to create a backdoor in seemingly secure computers, effectively allowing the government more access to surveillance of individuals and organizations. RSA acknowledges that it's working with the government, but on top of the revelation that RSA was providing the government with this kind of support, it was reported this winter that the NSA had secretly arranged to pay RSA Corporation $10 million for this backdoor access. This raised more than a few eyebrows. And it led to a boycott of sorts, or at least enough people opting out of the RSA conference to fill a new event called TrustyCon. The dueling conferences offer an opportunity to consider some of the changes that are taking place in the world of cybersecurity and what's often casually referred to as hacking. Is there a fundamental code of ethics, we wonder, for hackers? What makes one hacking assignment honorable and mission-like and another a sellout or collusion? With big money in play now, is hacking a mission, a mindset, or just a skill set? We'll talk this hour with some individuals working in the field of cybersecurity. And with us for the hour is Alex Stamos. He's Chief Technology Officer at Artemis Internet and co-founder of iSec Partners, a cybersecurity consulting firm. And he's also one of the lead organizers for TrustyCon. And also with us this hour is Vinnie Liu, a partner in the global security firm Bishop Fox, which provides attack and defense security services for Fortune 1000 companies. And we'll talk with both of those gentlemen in just a moment. But we want to start the program with our own KQED reporter, Arthi Shahani. She's been covering high tech extensively and is following the RSA and TrustyCon events here in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Arthi, I want to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about these events, what the conference is, does, was, and then also why the brouhaha? What's going on?
Sure. Well, the conference is going on all week, and RSA started just as a network security company in the 1980s, in 1982, and since then it actually got acquired. But this conference is basically a massive global community event for people that are involved in the security data encryption industry. It's probably the only place that you can go to where every other person you meet is a cryptographer, right, who works on securing data. And so the controversy this year, as you just paraphrased at the beginning, is really around the relationship between the RSA, which is a company and now basically a trade show with some skills workshops built into it, between the RSA and the National Security Agency. Reuters had broken a story that RSA allegedly accepted $10 million from the NSA, from the National Security Agency, to basically endorse and promote a kind of cryptography that had a backdoor and a sort of weakness. And so bear with me on the name. It's something called the Dual ECDRBG. You can get a sense for how, you know, user-friendly these terms are. Totally a mouthful. And the EC stands for elliptical curve. That might remind some of us of calculus classes we did or didn't want to be in. But basically, this kind of random number generator is actually weaker than other kinds of random number generators.
So the NSA asked RSA to deliberately make a weaker security system.
Well, that is exactly the story that broke with Reuters that allegedly for $10 million, the RSA decided to go ahead and endorse. And that would represent a real sea change in the relationship between the two entities. The RSA started back in, in the 90s, for example, in the mid 90s, actually championing cryptography that was stronger and protected against government hacking. And so the old leadership of the RSA would often talk about the need to defend the private sector against this kind of incursion. And so, the big meta conversation that you're going to have all over the conference, you talk to everyone there, plenty of the people who go there, they're like, hey, this is a trade show. I'm looking for interesting products. Everyone acknowledges there is a political context here that has shifted. That's a big question mark around it. I should say everyone acknowledges, except perhaps for the RSA organizers who kind of been, who have not been addressing it head on.
Well, and I should say we invited representatives from RSA to be on this program, and we very actively invited them, kept going back, but they declined to take part in the program. But staying with this this predicament, this situation, what are we talking about? Personal computers? Are we talking about just government mainframes? When this special cryptography backdoor was sort of programmed in or allowed, is that something that affects personal computers and individuals or just big organizations and corporations?
So we're talking about a product that actually affects all types of devices. And maybe one of the gentlemen here can actually talk about just how extensive it is.
Yeah, Alex Demos?
The algorithm we're talking about, Dual EC, was a government standard put out by NIST, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. And their goal was to make it something that was integrated in computers all around the world. The U.S. government has often been considered a fair dealer in setting cryptography standards that then people can trust and then allows personal systems, mobile phones, corporate systems to all interact and talk to each other. When they did this in 2006, actually very shortly afterwards in 2007, two researchers from Microsoft went up and gave a 15-minute talk at UC Santa Barbara at something called the Crypto Conference and said there's an interesting facts about this algorithm that make it very questionable. And after that, almost no company actually deployed it. Microsoft, per the government rules, implemented it but turned it off by default. And one of the controversies here is that RSA is really the only commercial company that used this algorithm in their default product until very shortly, several months ago, when they turned it off.
All right. Now, Arthi, back to you, because I want to stay kind of with these conferences for a little bit and also with the bigger issue of what people feel about their trust level with computers. You know, most folks, lay people, we think that if we have a cybersecurity system in our computer, if it says on the product that that's in, you know, already in the product, we have a level of trust. And in a story like this RSA story calls all of that into question. And are you finding that this story has changed the way even those in the industry who probably knew more than we did feel about trusting cybersecurity?
Yeah, well, you know what's interesting is that actually the conversation around trust has, maybe unsurprisingly, opened up a market opportunity. And so also this week, as we're seeing all these different products unveiled, one product that's coming to market that was just released or put on market on Monday is called Blackphone. Okay, and so Blackphone, like, listen, I use an Android, right, a Galaxy S3. And I, my phone basically emanates signals. And it speaks to beacons everywhere. And through the interaction, the invisible interaction it's having with the cyber world around me, all sorts of companies and the government, but also companies, can basically follow me, know where I go, know when I'm at Starbucks, that kind of thing, get my patterns down, market to me, basically get inside my mind in a quantified way that I'm not even aware of. And so Blackphone comes out and basically kills the conversation with the beacons and the mobile advertising and the data mining all around us. And so that product, what I think is interesting, is actually it's launched by or founded by a guy named Mike Jahnke, who's a former Navy SEAL, got a lot of his training in the military, like many of the people that are involved in security information protection, got his training there, had a company called Silent Circle, which helped to launch this product. And he's basically making a bet. His bet is that the market appetite for privacy is exploding and that post-NSA, Snowden leaks, and also post-Target hack, a lot of us as consumers are sensitive to this issue of privacy and are willing to pay for it.
Well, and this RSA story was a product of the Snowden leaks. Is that true?
In part.
Mm-hmm. It's so I think this idea, and I'd like you to talk a little bit more about other products that you think are coming out or you've heard about, because I think that's exactly what's going on. Is this RSA story is playing into our growing fear of our kind of the surveillance government, the surveillance culture that we live in, and what other things other than this black phone are going on that are playing into this?
Well, I'll tell you one more thing about the products, and it's that, you know, it's in part a fear of the government, though even the black phone makers say, hey, we're not NSA proof. If the NSA wants to hack you, they're going to hack you. And so it's not so much just that, but I think it's also just this general ecosystem where so much about us and our preferences can be digitally mined. And so is it that we value our privacy because we don't want the NSA in our minds? Is it that we value our privacy because we don't want, you know, XYZ company in our minds?
Well, or do we I mean, I think part of it is that we're hearing stories like this, that the government paid a cybersecurity company that's supposed to give us this sense of comfort to provide a backdoor, that makes all of us wisely paranoid. Alex Damos?
Yeah, I think this whole controversy is bringing up the difference between trust and security. Our industry, we even call it the information security industry, is really focused on technological protections and technological problems. I make a mistake in a piece of software and a hacker can take advantage of it to violate my privacy. But security's not sufficient. Security is a state where you build something that a system that acts like it's supposed to when somebody's attacking it. But that doesn't take into account the goals of the people that built that system. Trust is a much bigger and broader and harder to define idea about believing that the people who are building the systems that you rely on a day-to-day basis have your best interest in mind. And that's part of our goal of trying to expand the conversation this week, because security is great and it's necessary, but it's not enough.
Well, talk a little bit about TrustEcon. I mean, given the name, talk yes. a little bit about trust and about what you folks are hoping to do with your event.
Well, you know, we thought this was an opportunity to change the conversation a little bit, that there's been a groundswell of need for a conference that brings people from different parts of the life cycle of these products, not just the technologists that write the code and the security people that try to break it, but also the lawyers that create the rules and the government policies that control how companies act and interact with the government, and the product designers and the business people who are deciding whether or not trust is something that they want to make part of their corporate brand. And so, yeah, TrustEcon stands for the Trustworthy Computing, Trustworthy Technology Conference. And we really are trying to switch it around a little bit and get conversations between the lawyers and the business people and the geeks, and not just make it focused on very small scale. This is a bug that we had last year, and therefore, let's just address this bug. We want to broaden the conversation a bit and keep it going.
You know what's something I really wonder about is how adversarial versus friendly the relationship between companies and government is going to be and is evolving moving forward. And so just to give an example, you know, yesterday at the conference, Richard Clark spoke, okay? He is a former counterterrorism czar, has been in government since the Ford administration, actually now in the private sector as a consultant. And, you know, he said that the NSA is full of intelligent people. Let's not dump on them too much. You know, really, the ethos of how he feels is this is a really important agency. And his voice is interesting now because while he's critical of things that weaken cryptography, he also thinks it's important to keep the data mining going in ways that are efficient. So he was actually asked by President Obama to be part of a team that analyzed cybersecurity and NSA activity post-Snowden leaks. Okay, so Richard Clark, one of the recommendations issued by that committee, which includes Clark, is a recommendation that actually phone companies start keeping data that is more easily mineable by the government. So the government's not actually holding the data. The phone companies are, but it's easier to sift through. And so that's a sort of technocratic solution that I think politically is quite interesting. And I'm fascinated by how will everyone from Verizon to Google to, you know, to Yahoo, some companies which are currently in lawsuits right now over these things, how are they going to position themselves so that they can basically maximize their profits and not burn their consumer relationships.
Well, and it's also such a pragmatic approach. I mean, this is all about let's get away from the zealotry and the, you know, white hat of the hacker in the basement and also away from the big bad government story and find a pragmatic way to be both proactive in intelligence gathering but also not invading people's privacy. And Vinnie Lou, I want to go to you about kind of your take. You were working for you initially got recruited as a kid by the government because of your hacking skills. So talk a little bit about where somebody who works very much in the business of cybersecurity without sort of a dog in any fight, what you see about this debate between TrustyCon and RSA and what's going on.
Sure. Well, I think from our perspective, from a business standpoint, we work with a number of companies who are at the receiving end of the government's requests for information. We're working with people who are being affected by the revelations that the NSA is broken into a lot of these companies, American companies. And I think to Arthi's question about whether or not there's a adversarial relationship, I think it's fermenting. I think what you're going to see going forward, and a lot of our clients, they're concerned that the NSA's incursions upon their networks and their systems, the NSA's undermining essentially what Alex brought up, I think is a great distinction about the difference between trust and security, the trust that exists between a vendor and its customers. When the NSA comes in and backdoors things, it violates that trust and it damages their ability to provide their customers with that trust. It damages the confidence their customers have in their products and services, whether it's Yahoo or Google or any other company out there that's sort of been affected. That's where we know about the fact that they've been affected.
But what about – so getting back to the idea of pragmatism, though, I mean, as somebody who works with corporate interests or businesses, of course, they don't want to feel invaded themselves. But my guess is that they're busy playing offense, too, and using cybersecurity and possibly hacking techniques to get as much information as they can get and protect themselves. So they're probably – they don't want to be hacked, but they're, yes, hacking.
I wouldn't necessarily say that they're hacking, but I would say that they are. It's hard enough these days to make sure that you're secure, much less start to go after other people. I mean, especially companies with the proliferation of technology and the ubiquitousness of – I mean, it's everywhere these days. So when you have one app, right, and you have 20, 30 – I mean, 400 million users, a billion if you're Facebook, that's a bigger challenge than having enough time to even go start – messing around with somebody else.
That's actually your point, Penny. Your question does raise an interesting conversation that's been happening over the last year around hacking back, right? And so basically, some security companies have, you know, off the record and in closed rooms talked about how they are ready, willing, and able to use their cyber muscle to go in on offense defense, right? So go and find the intruders in proactive ways, deploying all sorts of intelligence, and, you know, possibly are getting away with some of this stuff because they come from the Defense Department. They have these relationships. But I think that that's a key thing is that, you know, when we're looking at the economy of cybersecurity in Silicon Valley, like there's so many startups. I mean, you know, your company is one of them, right? Bishop Fox, Vinny. You see so many different startups that are basically leveraging the relationships and the political capital that they've built in Washington, D.C. with the capital dollars that they're raising in Silicon Valley on Sand Hill Road and basically trying to figure out what does robust service look like? How much can I offer? Is there something I can do in the U.S.? And, oh, okay, if I can't do it in the U.S., can I go off seas to another country and do those kinds of services from there? All of that is coming up now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something very vibrant startup security culture, Silicon Valley. I mean, everywhere. Alex, I don't know if you see the same thing.
Well, and I agree, and Artie's right that there's a huge movement of people between the government and private industry. I have an ex-NSA friend who joked about their inability to keep people at the NSA because you work there for 4 or 5 years, you have incredible skills, and you're stuck working in a windowless basement in Maryland.
Oh, yeah. I would imagine there's lots of flow. Talking this hour about cybersecurity, the industry, the business, a bit about kind of the ethics behind some of it, which we'll get into more as we go along. Right now, we're tackling the topic of the RSA conference, which is going on in San Francisco. RSA coming under some scrutiny and criticism for its relationship with the U.S. government in surveillance opportunities. And then TrustyCon, a conference that has sprung up sort of as a result of that scrutiny and criticism and offering another avenue for looking at cybersecurity. And that conference is going on tomorrow in San Francisco. With us for the program is Arthi Shahani. She's a reporter here at KQED following a lot of high-tech topics and covering these events going on this week. Also with us, Alex Stamos, Chief Technology Officer at Artemis Internet and co-founder of iSEC Partners, which is a cybersecurity consulting firm and also also one of the folks that organized TrustyCon. And just speaking was Vinny Liu. He's a partner in a global security firm called Bishop Fox, which provides attack and defense security services for companies. Arthi, I know we have to let you go at the half hour. Before you go, I'm curious what the response, as you've heard it as a reporter from RSA, has been to the criticism, to the folks speaking at the conference, and to TrustyCon.
I haven't heard response specifically about this criticism. They've been, frankly, very helpful in connecting me to all sorts of experts in industry as I'm covering different products that are coming out, as I'm talking about different issues. They've evaded this issue of the criticism.
Now, the chief executive of RSA did speak, but Art Coviello, but it sounds from everything we saw like he really danced around.
Yeah,
the
He gave a keynote address yesterday, and he totally stopped short of talking about the $10 million and the encryption backdoor issue.
Is the $10 million really the thing that's the burr under the saddle here? Or because they acknowledge that they're working with the government, and he even said, and I think I read in Wired magazine, he said, federal government is a customer, and we gave the customer what the customer wants. Alex Stamos,
right? You're not going to find a major tech company that doesn't have the U.S. government as a customer in money flow. I think what's more concerning here is that RSA was the only company out of pretty much all the major commercial software vendors that was duped into including this backdoor. And so that's what's suspicious to folks is that—
Wait, duped as in they claim they didn't know what they were doing.
And I find that plausible. I find it unlikely that the NSA or NIST would share the secret about the backdoor. It was a published standard that was pushed in.
I have difficulty believing
Vinny Liu is having—
Okay, let me
here,
let me.
I'm defending RSA.
Yeah,
go ahead,
I know. So here's the thing. Okay, I think the irony is that RSA is not the commercial brand. When it first started, RSA referred to a cryptographic algorithm that was actually designed to allow people to create trust on the internet. And what we're talking about here is RSA doing the exact opposite of that. I don't know if anybody— here's the thing. They're a cryptography company.
As a layperson, my thinking is if RSA didn't know, shame on them if this is their business.
The best case scenario is it's cryptographic malpractice. Right, they are a cryptography company. Yeah. You pay a doctor to tell you how to treat your cancer. You pay a cryptography company to tell you how to use crypto.
All right. Well, we are talking this hour about cybersecurity, hacking, and eventually we're going to get into some of the ethics around hacking. But right now we're very captivated by the story around RSA and the TrustyCon conference that has sprung up as a result. And we'd love to hear from you in the audience, folks that may have this particular skill set, people that have worked in the industry and have some insider knowledge, or just those of you using computers and having questions about whether or not you can trust these secure, supposedly encrypted programs that you're using. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's the number to call, 866-733-6786, to join in the conversation. You can also email any questions you have or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on the website, kqed.org/forum. Talking this hour with Arthi Shahani. She's a reporter here at KQED who follows high tech and has been helping us understand sort of the basics of the story. Also with us, Alex Stamos, who is a participant in TrustyCon and was one of the organizers. He's also a tech officer the chief tech officer at Artemis Internet, and Vinny Liu, who is a partner at Bishop Fox, which is a global security firm. And I want to emphasize that we emphatically invited folks from RSA to join us for the hour or for part of it, for a comment, to be part of the conversation, but they declined the invitation. So unfortunately, we don't have somebody from that conference on the program. Well, we'll be back after a short break. I'm Penny Nelson, sitting in for Michael Krasny, and we're looking forward to hearing from you when we come back. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson. This hour, we're discussing cybersecurity as a business and those who are working in the field. This week in San Francisco, RSA, which is a major cybersecurity corporation, is holding its annual trade show and conference. It's been holding that for about 20 years or so now. And recent revelations that RSA supported U.S. government efforts to access a vast number of computers for surveillance purposes by offering a technology, sort of a back backdoor access into their security programs and was paid allegedly $10 million for doing so. That that has led to something of a boycott of the RSA show and the creation of a new conference called TrustyCon that's taking place tomorrow in San Francisco. And with us to talk about the industry and hacking and the conferences and all of that is Alex Stamos. He's a participant and an organizer of TrustyCon and also a chief technology officer for Artemis Internet. And Vinny Liu is with us as well. He's a corporate security firm partner at Bishop Fox. And both of these guests are cybersecurity experts and people who work in the field. We had invited folks from RSA to join us for the program, but they declined the invitation. Alex Stamos, I want to go to you to talk a little bit about TrustyCon and what the showing has been, what you've been hearing from people, why they've chosen to go to TrustyCon rather than RSA, and if they're doing both. Also, how many folks have signed up?
So TrustyCon, the Trustworthy Technology Conference, we're going to have 400 seats. So we weren't able to get a very large facility. As you can imagine, RSA is a huge conference, and so pretty much everything's booked up in San Francisco. And the whole thing got put together in about 10 days, actually. And so we have a movie theater. We're going to be at the Metreon, literally looking down at the RSA conference in Moscone. And we sold out those 400 tickets in about 4 days. We have 300 people on the waiting list. And it's been a fantastic feedback from folks.
Well, let me jump in here because my understanding is that you initially didn't like the idea of a boycott.
I didn't. And I never called for people to boycott. I feel like if there are technologists who want to speak out on behalf of companies acting in a trustworthy manner, that they shouldn't silence their own voices. And that's really why we started this conference, is that 13 people, a lot of whom I have great respect for and I really was looking forward to hearing from, decided to drop out and boycott the RSA conference, and I wanted to give them a platform where they could still be heard.
Well, what is the rift in the cybersecurity community? What's the feeling?
There's a couple of rifts. One of the arguments is whether or not the RSA Corporation was just tricked into putting this backdoor into their software, or if they were knowingly doing so because of the $10 million payment from the NSA. The other rift is whether or not the conference is actually that closely tied to RSA, the company, and whether it's good to pull yourself out of the conversation and therefore leave it only to the voices of folks who don't care so much about this topic.
Would either of you say there's a white hat, black hat element to the cybersecurity community? Are folks dividing themselves up according to people who are working sort of with a zealotry or a mission as opposed to those who are working because they've got a skill set and this is a viable business?
I would definitely say, so usually the term white hat and black hat has been historically used for black hats are people who are trying to break in and white hats are doing defense and making things better. And the white hat community is much more complicated than it used to be. 7-8 years ago, it was really easy to be a white hat because all you had to do is play defense. You could have a reasonable but distant relationship to the U.S. government. And you could do security research and publish your findings and not worry about the ethics so much. These days, it's much more complicated. You have white hat researchers whom used to do public disclosure and say, I found this bug, I want it fixed, who instead of publicly talking about it, write a weapon. They weaponize and write code that can be used to exploit that and then sell it to either our government or on the open market to whomever wants to buy it. And that kind of thing that wasn't going on 8-9 years ago makes it much more ethically difficult to be in our industry.
Do Vinny Liu, do corporate interests ask you to do things that you find ethically challenging?
As Alex mentioned, there are shades. It's not as easy as black and white. And I think what happens is there's a spectrum of things that, and Arthi mentioned earlier, there are corporate interests who are interested in using their own teams to be more offensive. And they're looking for the permission or the legal framework in which to operate and perform those types of actions because as attackers get more aggressive, they want to push back. Nobody just wants to keep getting pushed around. So in a lot of cases, we do get requests. Obviously, it's very, very sensitive, and we have to be very careful about what we do to make sure that we operate within the constraints of the law for our customers.
And is the law clear?
I think the law is old and outdated, and I think that what you'll find a lot of people talking about at TrustyCon and what you'll find a lot of people talking about in general is the fact that the legal framework has not kept up with the evolving technology.
All right. Well, there's a lot of directions to go in with that question, and I'd love to get to it, but I really want to go to some of our calls as well. We've got Peter calling from Oakland. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. One is you guys were talking about, just the idea of privacy itself. And like when things like this happen, it sort of, people start to call into question why they even need privacy, what, like, as if it needs to be justified. And I think, you know, the issue of privacy goes way beyond whether or not somebody's going to hack into Kmart and, you know, steal a bunch of identity and make money off that. You know, privacy is something that we own ourselves, and we have every right to just control it and not have anybody else, you know, do what they like with it. And the other thing is, there was a reference to paying for privacy. So I mean, as a consumer, I really don't want to have to start paying for privacy. I think that things that I do that are not
by buying security systems, by buying McAfee or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys were talking about the potential of having to pay for privacy, having to pay for more security, and I don't know. It seems like there's this idea that that we're going to just like give up our privacy and companies will make us pay more for it. I mean, yeah, that's true. There already is like McAfee and other software that we pay for.
Yeah,
but I think it feels like it's going beyond that.
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting is when a lot of people that are just regular folks out there like me buy a computer and it has a security system built in, I have this element of trust that I believe that that's part and parcel with what I'm buying. And there's a trust element, and stories like this, and then, of course, all the revelations of late, all the breaches, the Target breach, the NSA, all of it makes us users on the internet freeway go, wow, maybe we are way more exposed than we realize we are. But Peter, thanks for the call. And a couple of comments that have come in online. Ben writes, the idea that the government hacking and backdooring is somehow shocking is ridiculous. Most of the technology used today was developed by the government 25 years ago, when only a handful of people used tech like they do today. And it was understood the government was watching. This technology is quite powerful. And for the government to keep their noses out would not only be impossible, it would endanger its citizens. So that's what Ben has to say. And Frank writes, the NSA has found eager participants in spying at most of the big corporations. They can listen to your Skype calls, record your phone calls, read all your text messages, track you for using your phone wherever you go, break the internet's encryption, track Google, on and on he goes on. The Stasi never had even a thousandth of the spying capabilities the NSA had. We should be boycotting major U.S. tech. So that's what Frank has to say. Either of you want to jump in and comment on that?
I think Frank's got a really interesting point in that, about the boycotting of U.S. tech. What the NSA has done is created a mistrust between companies and their vendors, and a lot of those vendors are U.S. tech companies, U.S. companies that, if they're found out to have colluded with the NSA, I think the question is not whether or not there are other organizations who are going to come into the limelight like RSA, but when. When are we going to find out about it? Because it's absurd to think that the NSA just stopped with RSA and decided, oh, well, this worked great. Let's find another way to do it.
Well, as two people who are deep in the business, how secure do you feel our basic public use of technology is?
Oh, it's bad. We have failed the technology industry and the information security industry. We have completely failed you and every normal person who walks around using a computer and a cell phone and believes they're safe. We really need to be building systems that are safe by default that normal people can use securely. You know, have you ever gotten that pop-up that pops up when you're in a Starbucks or a Marriott or something, and it says you have a certificate mismatch, and you say, okay, well, tell me more, and then it gives you a huge page of information that you have to have a degree in discrete mathematics to understand. That is a failure every time that happens, and that happens millions of times a day. So I don't feel that great about it, not because we can't do it, but we haven't focused on building software that's safe in the same way that you build cars that are safe or bridges that are safe. We build software that in some situations can be secure if only used by people who are very technologically sophisticated.
Now, why? Is there not the money in doing that? Why is it that if that's a niche to be filled, why isn't it being filled?
I think on the consumer side, one of the unfortunate parts is that consumers don't make decisions of what technology they use based upon their appearance of safety, right? You would never buy a car that doesn't have airbags or seatbelts, but people buy computers that don't have the equivalent all the time. And until consumers start being educated and pushing the companies they buy from to keep them safe the entire time, there's really not going to be a change.
And I think that's great from a consumer perspective, and that's related to what Peter was talking about in terms of having to buy privacy from the Black Phone, for example, that Arthi mentioned. Because you now you know that there's a phone that's going to protect your privacy. Previously, I think to Alex's point, we failed in that there was no option available for people. Now, on the business side, I think the same thing is going to happen because businesses are now demanding U.S. tech companies show them that they're secure. And if not, we're not gonna work with you.
Well, and if there's a driving motive, you know, if there's an interest out there, that black phone, my understanding is that it costs about $600 some. So it's much more expensive. But if the drive is there for companies to get hold of these things, and if the market is there for people to buy them, you can be sure. And I think with all these revelations, it's increasingly going to be the case. Rachel in Pittsburgh, join us.
Hi. One of the things that I find really interesting is the kind of the total lack of any discussion. Well, I shouldn't say total lack, but there's certainly a lag in discussion among people who have a legal duty, lawyers, other people who have confidential information of, you know, how we're supposed to deal with the issues that we can't protect any of the information. I'm a lawyer. I also work as a child advocate appointed by the court for kids who are in foster homes. I have increasingly all this information is, you know, we put in our computers, any discussions we have over the phone, any of this stuff can come back to bite these foster kids, you know, years from now. Very, very, very sensitive information about them.
Well, let me ask you, Rachel, as a lawyer, because I think one of the things that's so interesting, what Vinny was even just saying, is that the law sort of hasn't kept up with the technology. As a lawyer, even if this isn't your field, can you imagine trying to prosecute a case based on privacy around something as kind of vague and undefined and in process, really, as cybersecurity and hacking? And when does corporate espionage become breaking in versus just defense? I mean, as a lawyer, I would imagine this would make your head spin.
Yeah. Not only would it be difficult from a lawyer's standpoint, but to even get any, even if you did it before a judge and not before a jury, to get anyone to understand all the intricacies would be almost impossible. But I'm just concerned because I've been looking and looking at, you know, we are required to take CLE every year. There are no real good classes about how do we go about. We have a duty, a legal duty, to protect this privileged information, and yet there's no way we're doing that.
Right.
None.
All right. Well, thanks, Rachel. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to John, who's calling us in Half Moon Bay. Hi, John.
Hi. My question for the panelists is to give us some perspective on the – there's a lot of publicity has been about the NSA. The NSA has at least nominally got some oversight from the government, but what about the actual and potential abuse of all the information that's being collected privately?
You mean when Starbucks or – I mean private companies gathering our data as we shop in the store?
Yeah, all the data collection that goes on by, you know, Google and Yahoo and Amazon, and the fact that, you know, because I've had some sort of commercial transaction with you, you have a perpetual and proprietary right to sell that information to anyone without disclosure to me.
Well, I think that's sort of a different topic because it's definitely, you know, part of our interest as public citizens. But as far as cybersecurity, other than the things that that Vinny was mentioning about the black phone and Arthi was mentioning about products, that's just that tracking thing that's going on. I would put to you, Vinny, what are you hearing from corporate clients about, you know, this is sort of the year of the hyper breach. You know, we've got the NSA thing, we've got Target, we've got RSA. I'm sure there's so many things that we're not even aware of that are going on. Is there among your clients and maybe among yours as well, Alex, a growing concern that this is all spinning out of control?
I think what I'm hearing from my clients is not so much that it's spinning out of control. I mean, certainly there's a lot more press given to these things. You know, in the past, you wouldn't hear about them as often because you weren't required to disclose when something like this would happen. There were no requirements that you had to notify your customers. And so that's one result of this. I think the number of attacks are getting more sophisticated, and I think people are worried about the fact that they can't defend themselves. Our clients are really worried that the sophistication and the number are increasing at a rate that they can't keep up with.
Alex Samos?
Yeah, I agree. The funny thing is this vulnerability has always existed. We just haven't had enough bad guys. And that's what's changed in the last 5-6 years is both the quality and the quantity of people who are able to monetize or utilize these attacks to their benefit have gone way up. And what you see now in 2014 is what governments were doing to each other in 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. We were involved in responding to the Aurora attacks, which were the Chinese government breaking into 35 American companies. That's the exact same kind of technique we see from, say, an Eastern European organized crime syndicate use against modern companies, the exact same kind of techniques that were new and expensive and deployed by the People's Liberation Army in 2009. And the truth is the median American company does not have the skill set or the technology in-house to deal with that level of adversary. And I think that's why we're starting to see this huge bulge is that the defenders at the median company have fallen way behind.
I would go on to say, I mean, you know, along those lines, we responded to a lot of similar stuff, anonymous, LulzSec type of activity against our clients. And one of the things that we saw was that, and I don't know if you know this, noticed this as well, Alex, but I think in the conventional warfare, you know, you've got a big gap between what normal people can get access to and then, you know, a tank and a nuclear weapon. But in cybersecurity, the people who, you know, the people who are sitting in basements or the people in Eastern Europe, these crime syndicates, can get the talent and develop the technology themselves at the same level the governments are operating at. In fact, it's the case that a lot of private exploits and vulnerabilities are being developed outside of government purview and then being sold to governments because they don't have the capability or the staff or resources to do it themselves.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Vinny's got a great point. And you see the exact same weapons trickle down into the private market. Mm-hmm. For example, the Stuxnet worm, which is widely believed to be the United States to be involved with, which infected Iranian computers, the exact code had been ripped out of that and used to target a number of American companies because the lag time is so long on people defending themselves even against known vulnerabilities.
Boy, so these attacks being referred to truly as weapons, and that's end of sort of international corporate or business or governmental warfare online. Talking this hour about cybersecurity, and with us is Vinny Liu and Alex Stamos. Alex Stamos is one of the organizers of TrustyCon, a conference going on in San Francisco tomorrow. And Vinny Liu is a partner with a global security firm called Bishop Fox. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to do so is 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. A couple more comments over here that I'll go to. Richard writes, your speaker mentioned Richard Clark's proposal that the private sector hold a metadata database instead of the federal government holding the database. And Richard thinks this is a horrible idea. Says this would put the data at greater risk while putting it under many fewer restrictions. Even with the NSA and the FBI being lying about whether or not they're following the law, their behavior is much more constrained than the private sector would be. And Holly writes, oh, good. This is a good question. Holly writes, what exactly is a backdoor? So, Vinny Liu.
I think it's sort of a simple way of thinking about a backdoor is an alternative way of getting in. So if you have your house, right, and you know, you get your locks on your doors and you've got your windows closed and everything's secured, a backdoor, say, having, you know, a secret tunnel that you can use to get into the house that nobody knows about. Maybe that's 30 feet out in buried in the backyard somewhere.
And when RSA did what they did for the NSA, for the U.S. government, they weakened. They didn't actually open the door, but they weakened the encryption code that is used in computers? Is that
what they did is the U.S. government published an encryption code, and RSA adopted that and made it the default in their product when pretty much everybody else in the world decided not to because of the work of Microsoft researchers saying, wow, they actually have a slide that says, we're not saying there's a back door, but this thing looks awfully fishy. We're not going to use it. Which apparently that slide never made it to RSA headquarters.
I want to ask you both to kind of go into a little vaguer area here, and you may not agree on this, but do either of you feel like there ever was an ethical code for hackers of any sort? And if there was, do you feel like it's changing?
I'll let Vinny answer that one. Go ahead, Vinny.
Like, there's this mythology about the hacker that they're down there, you know, saving the little guy and protecting the freedom of
information. I'm really glad that's what you're saying, though, because a lot of times hackers are portrayed in a very negative light. Yeah. But the fact that you're saying that, yeah, we're out there fighting for the rights of the common man, perhaps, you know. But I think hacking has always been more about curiosity and interest and looking for ways to, play with systems in interesting and clever ways that other people haven't. And I think when people start talking about white hat, black hat and the ethics of it, it's all about intent. Years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago when I was first getting started in the industry, I think a lot of it was based around exploration and knowledge. There wasn't a channel or a marketplace for selling exploits. Those things didn't exist. You couldn't get $200,000, $300,000 for a single vulnerability in one of Apple's products. But today there is. Back then, you couldn't hack Target and get all of those credit card numbers and find a buyer for it too and have an entire ecosystem that would facilitate that. So what you did was you played around with your friends and you hacked things.
Yeah, and I think Vinny's totally right. I don't think the people have changed, the hackers. The environment in which young people are growing up in has totally changed. I'm probably a little older than Vinny. So when I got started in this industry unofficially, playing around with 300 baud modems in the 80s, there was really very little damage we could do and very little intention to do damage. It was kids playing around, having a good time. Now, with the same kind of skill set, a 15-year-old could make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
And both of you got – you referred to a letter that both of you received. What is this letter when you were young, Gurr?
I got a – so this is almost cheesy, but I got a message on IRC. So
I don't know what IRC is.
I got a message on an online chat
online
channel.
Chat.
Yeah. It was the chat before chat was popular.
And the message was?
It was the AOL Instant Messenger of the hacker world.
And the message said?
Hey, I've got some people that you should meet. And the funny thing is that I had known this person for many years online, and he referred me to the agency.
Referred you to what agency?
The NSA.
The NSA. Yeah. So as a kid on a chat site, you got noticed and picked up and referred to the NSA.
And the interesting thing is I never met the guy. I've never met the guy in person who referred me. But I've known him online for ages.
So people are trolling these and looking for the talent. And yeah. Alex, you received a similar sort of chat message.
I didn't get a chat message. I got an actual letter with a nice embossed NSA seal saying, we'd like you to come visit and apply for our scholarship program. NSA, it's just like the military, right? They'll go and they find kids that they think have talent. They'll give them a scholarship to go to college. They'll pay for it. You intern there. And then you owe them 4 or 5 years or something after you get out.
All right. Let's go to Ellen, who's calling us from San Francisco. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I was wondering, I know there's a lot of talk about corporations, cybersecurity, and government, but just as an everyday consumer and person, I'm just wondering what the panel guests are doing to protect themselves and their families just on a daily basis. The options are kind of overwhelming.
That's a great question. Ellen, that's a great question. So as people who know the business, Alex, Vinny, what do you do to protect yourselves from being hacked or being invaded?
Well, what I do to protect myself is not anything that I could teach anybody to do. What I've done for my parents and my in-laws is, and I'm not trying to endorse a specific product here, but the simplest way is I try to buy family members not full computers, right? So my kids use iPads, and I got my parents and my in-laws Chromebooks, right, which basically are just web browsers and have a lot of security and are much harder to get hacked on them.
What's Apple security like?
Oh, that's a great question because they're in the middle of a big controversy right now. They had a huge, humongous security bug where basically none of their encryption has been working for the last year, which came out last week. They patched it for the iPhone and then they waited 4 or 5 days to patch it for Macs. So Apple generally does a pretty good job, but in some cases they make mistakes like everybody else.
And Vinny, what do you do to protect your own interests in the cybersecurity realm?
I think the most common attack vector for the common consumer is going to be through the web. It's through the browsers. And you've got to worry about going to bad sites and all the stuff that you've probably heard a million times over. There's a specific technology that I use, which it's called sandboxing your browsers. And I think there's that goes a long way to preventing malicious software from being downloaded onto your system.
Is that a program that somebody buys or is that a behavior pattern or something?
It can be a program that you buy. Sandboxing refers to the technique of essentially creating a wall around your browser so that it can't access the rest of your computer system.
How?
Essentially by mimicking, by creating a copy of your computer and letting your browser run inside of it in a virtual environment.
Okay, so if I couldn't figure that out on my own, I find somebody who knows what sandboxing is.
If you download Google Chrome, they do sandbox in all the major operating systems. So probably the best two things you can do is use Chrome on whatever OS you're on, and be very careful about phishing attacks, right? If you get an email that says, please give us your username and password, it's probably not legitimately the company you think it is.
All right. What do you think is the big cybersecurity issue coming up next that we're going to be facing before we can turn around?
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing a lot has happened now is in very much the same way that the market and the environment has changed from just playing around online with your friends into this sort of market of stealing identities, stealing credit cards and things like that. What you're seeing is businesses have adopted it. Now consumers are seeing internet pervade every aspect of their lives as well. And the oft referred to Internet of Things is going to be another avenue for attackers to take advantage of. So I think there's going to be some interesting news come up in the next couple of years around how internet and security are being integrated into everyday consumer products.
So people using it for all of their shopping needs, basically, is what you're saying.
Shopping needs, baby monitors being connected to the internet that you can use now, your thermostats, your smoke detectors, everything is getting integrated, your TVs.
Wow. And Alex, very quickly, any big issues you see around the corner?
I think it's going to be interesting to see what's left in the Snowden documents.
All right. Oh, my word. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's it for this hour. It went fast. That was Alex Stamos of Artemis Internet and co-founder of iSEC Partners, a cybersecurity consulting firm. And he is also a co-organizer of the TrustyCon conference going on tomorrow. And go to our website for information about TrustyCon or RSA if you want more information. Vinnie Liu's also been with us, partner at Bishop Fox, a global security firm providing attack and defense security services. And earlier in the hour, we heard from KQED's reporter, Aarti Shahani, on what's going on with these conferences. And we did invite members from RSA to be with us for the hour, but they declined. Well, we'll have as much as we can on the topic on our website. Go to that at kqed.org/forum. I'm Penny Nelson, sitting in for Michael Kresny, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.